Let there be light. It is good morning, everyone. Great to see everybody. Glad to hear all of the good football activities going on, things of this nature. So Thayer, does that make you Kellen Moore? You're the offensive coordinator of the thing? Pretty much, okay. Sawyer's team there. Yeah, I'm assuming you have a Dallas Cowboys background when I say that kind of thing. Hey, apparently it makes a difference. So that's a huge deal out there doing those things. Again, just really good always to be with you guys. This has been more than a challenging week for me, and if I have the opportunity, I'll maybe get into that a little bit later. But it does look like we have a break in the weather coming up starting around Thursday. I'm kind of seeing a cooling trend there, so maybe that'll make the weather at some of these outdoor sporting events a little more bearable. I just know Friday night was pretty rough for our homecoming game. But fortunately, the home team prevailed, and so everything is looking good. Let's begin in prayer this morning, as usual. Our Father in heaven, we are grateful to have this time together today to be able to share our lives with each other, the different things that are going on, to be able to share the victories, to be able to share the struggles that are going on, to be able to help each other, to be able to laugh with each other, cry with each other, eat with each other. We're looking forward to that time as well, Lord, after our service today. But we're especially thankful this morning, Father, for the person who makes it all possible, for Jesus, and for everything that he has done for us, for everything that he continues to do for us right up until this present moment. So, Father, would you send Jesus? Would you send the Holy Spirit? Would you, God the Father, all three, the Holy Trinity, just be with us here this morning, and may everything done today be done ultimately for the building up of the body, for the encouragement, for the edification of each other, Lord. And we're just thankful for the body. We're thankful for God's family. For we ask it all in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen. Well, you are what you love. I think we got that by now, right? Okay. It's super important what you love, and it's super important what we have our hearts set on. There are reviews available to you if you missed any of the previous. This is number 12 in the series, and so if you go to that website, you can certainly review any and all of that material. The heart's really important because the routines and the habits that we engage in, they steer our hearts towards what we love, and they cultivate that love in our hearts. And so the heart's a big deal here. The reason why we're focusing on it so much is that it's both compass and guidance system. It's not only pointing us towards things based upon these habits and these routines that we engage in, but it's also drawing us towards those things. That's why the scripture is so clear about guarding your hearts and all of these kinds of things. And so what we ultimately love is so very, very, very important. We can love a lot of things, but what we ultimately love, it's what's important, because that'll be God to us. And so we all have some counterfeit gods in our life. And so I want to tie into another book that I can highly recommend to you this morning, Counterfeit Gods by Timothy Keller. If you're not familiar with Tim Keller, got a lot of YouTube videos out there. I really like him, one, because we're kind of the same age, and I think we're from similar backgrounds, and we kind of have some experiences that I think we both share. And so I think it's interesting from that viewpoint. But I also think he's a very gifted teacher, and I think he has some really good insights. So I just want to gratefully acknowledge him this morning. First thing I want to bring up to us today, you know, it's good that we just go back and ask ourselves every now and then, does what we believe make sense? Does what we believe make, does a Christian worldview make sense? I mean, it should. If this is reality, if it does correspond to, you know, what's out there, then it should make sense. And since there are these competing images out there that try to draw our hearts in, that entice us to love them, whether it be the stay thirsty guy, they stay thirsty my friend guy that we've talked about, the shopping malls, all the advertisements that we see, buy this and you'll be somebody, have these kinds of clothes, drive this kind of car, you know, whatever it might be. Those are the things that are saying, you know, you should love these things. You should put these up on the highest priority there. That's the way you should look at things. As opposed to a biblical worldview, a biblical view of reality. See, I think that's how we can know that these other views are counterfeit, that they are false. I firmly believe that a biblical worldview just makes sense. Frankly, if I didn't, I wouldn't believe it. I don't think you would either. You know, I don't think if it made some kind of sense to you, you know, you wouldn't live it. You wouldn't stake your life on it, so to speak. And I really do think that it helps us to explain the human condition, because as we look at the condition of the heart, Scripture has some very interesting things to say about it. For instance, in Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? This just runs totally counter to all the messages I see out there in our culture. I was watching some TV show or movie the other day where they were just telling the person, hey, just trust your heart. You know, just listen to your heart. Well, what if your heart is deceitful? What if your heart is wicked? I mean, why is there this assumption that by default your heart is just good there? And if that's the case, why does it's one of my favorite verses, by the way, Ezekiel 36, 26, and then 27 and following, where God makes a promise to his people that at some point in my covenant relationship with you, I'm going to give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I'll remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. This is what happens on Pentecost. This is the exciting thing to live post-Pentecost, is that now God has moved in such a way to change our hearts that had become disjointed, that had become messed up, that had become in a state that we really don't want them, you know, to be in there. You know, a new spirit, a new heart, God coming to live in us here. And I just think this is just super important that we recognize here that we have help with this. You know, I can't just say I'm going to change my heart. I need help with that. I need the divine heart surgeon, if you will, to put a new heart inside of me. I need to change, but I need help with that. And I think the reason why we know this is probably the one Christian doctrine that has empirical proof, you know, to it, that all you got to do is look and see the reality of sin. If there were no sin, and I've actually talked to some skeptics sometime that tell me they don't believe in sin. You know, well, I think I make mistakes. I don't think I sin, you know. And I'm thinking, how much life have you really lived? How much looking around at people's behavior and your own behavior have you ever seen? I joke sometimes with people, you know, well, I think people are basically good. Have you ever been to a public washroom? You ever been in a public washroom and you think people are basically good? You know, I think, you know, that's kind of trivial. I understand there, but I mean, that's, you know, that's one place to start looking, you know, right there. Sin is evident, you know. Do we really need a Bible to tell us that all people sin and fall short of the glory of God? I think it's just evident out there. Freud called it the id. You know, there's these aggressive tendencies and, you know, they're just there. They're just there innately. Charles Darwin the founder of the modern version of the theory of evolution, things of this nature. You know, he said, we're all driven by what? Self-interest. We actually, he thought it was genetic. Dawkins and modern day, you know, evolutionists will call it, wrote a book called The Selfish Gene. We just kind of have a tendency in us there to be selfish. And then think about these expressions that people use. How many times have you heard this? Well, you know, nobody's perfect. You know. Well, you know, that's just human nature. You know. Now, that's stating what's obvious there, right? We would all agree with that. We've all used those expressions. The thing is, why is it true that no one's perfect? Why is it true that, you know, there's parts of human nature that are not, you know, not good there? We wouldn't use that expression, you know, otherwise. Why is that the case? This is where I think a biblical worldview, some kind of doctrine of sin, and by the way, there's different flavors of this within Christians. You know, there's not just total agreement on what exactly that means, but there is, I think, total agreement of the fact that it's there, you know. There's something there called sin, and we all engage in it. Otherwise, if that were not the case, why do we talk about this? Salvation. Why are we in need of salvation unless something has drastically gone wrong in people? You only need salvation if, you know, something's obviously bad there, okay? So what is it that you turn to for your salvation? I want to suggest to you that that's one way of looking at an idol in your life, okay? And I want to ask us this morning, you know, well, how do we know what those idols are with us? I mean, how are we going to address that issue with, because we don't all have the same idols. We may have some in common, you know, right? There's probably some, you know, some big commonalities out there. But it's really important. If I'm to address the idolatry in my own life, okay, it helps to know what those things are. What is it that's snuck up on me here, so to speak, and has become that idol there? So I want to ask yourself this. I want us to encourage ourselves to ask ourselves this morning. What thing or person, if you've lost it, you would lose your will to live? What thing right now, if you think, oh, if I lost this person, or if I lost this stuff, I just don't know if I could go on. Let me just suggest to you, whatever that person or thing is, that's become an idol with you. Not that it's bad to really love a person or people, or not that it's bad to enjoy some things and things like this, but that's the thing that gives you this false salvation, this false redemption here. That's the thing that gives you your sense of identity, your sense of self-worth, a measure of security. But now, let me back up in saying this. I really don't want to be misunderstood here. I'm not saying that those things in themselves can't be good things. I think they are good things. If you love your spouse so intently that you would think, oh, I would just really be devastated if they passed away, I think that's only proper and natural. I think it's only proper and natural in that. But how high does that sense of the ultimate or the priority go there? You know, if that's something that you value more than God and love more value and love more than God, then that's got the priorities out of whack there. That's become not just a good thing in your life, which is entirely proper, but it's become an ultimate thing. In some sense, idols are just good things that have gotten out of order. You know, problem is what? When we look to them to give us what only God can. What only God, the place that only God can occupy in our lives. The place that, you know, the stuff that only God can give us there. So let's talk about some of those things just real quick on this particular slide here. I want you to think about these things. Career, family, children, personal achievement, giving yourself to a political cause. Physical attractiveness, a sense of approval from others, power, comfort, and financial security. Anything wrong with any of those things? No. They're all good things, except what? When they become the ultimate thing in your life. See, Augustine, who I've always just greatly admired, except for the biblical writers, you know, I put Augustine up there pretty high. I think he's a smart fella. Augustine said, "The essence of sin is disordered love." Another quote from him, "For when we ask whether somebody is a good person, we're not asking what he believes or hopes for, but what he loves." What you love is what makes you good, makes you a good person. There's something has captured our heart there, and that ultimate thing must be God. Now, what that means is all those other things we talked about, whether it be career, family, personal achievement, power, whatever we're talking about, it's really great if we have those on a secondary level, but not on the ultimate level there. This is where I always go to, back to one of my favorite movies. You know, think about this for a second. How should you prioritize your family with a career? What should come first? Well, we need go no further than Dale Griffith, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles again here, right? There's one part in this movie where he shares with the Steve Martin character, "I got a motto, like your job, love your wife." That's pretty good there. That's pretty good. Like your job, love your wife. You know, sometimes I think when we look at the Bible, we study these ancient cultures sometimes, and like that we hear about the Canaanites having child sacrifice. Well, I think we're very justly appalled by that. I mean, what was wrong with these ancient cultures? I mean, they sacrificed babies and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, I think about that sometimes. I wonder how many people, at least in a symbolic sense, sacrifice their kids on the altar of career advancement and career achievement. Put their job achievement at such a high level that they sacrifice the time that they rightly should be spending with their spouse and with their children. Isn't that some form of child sacrifice there? I mean, those are hard questions for us all to ask, and it is tough to find that balance, believe me. You know, I've gone through that just like, you know, many of you here today, and some of you currently are. It's hard to find that balance, but I think this is it. Like your job, love your wife and your family. Because the problem with these idols is, what do they do ultimately? They'll break your heart. You put those first, you put them ultimately, you put them at the thing your heart loves the most. It ultimately ends up breaking your heart, because what occurs to me is what? None of these idols will ever love you back. None of these idols will ever love you back. The emptiness I felt when I was way too involved with pornography was that none of those mental images ever loved me back. They didn't know me. They didn't care about me. They just wanted to use me up and spit me out and leave you feeling very used and alone and miserable at the end of it. They just don't love you back. And unfortunately, this is what many people are looking to for their meaning in life. And I know you know this just as well as you. I mean, think about in American society, what do we look to as a culture, as a secular culture, most to give us meaning? I want to propose these three things to you. There's the romantic solution, right? You see it in the movies, you know, the slow motion of the two people running towards each other in the field. You know, the violins are playing, you know, da da ba da 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 da, you know, classic romantic music and all of that. And it, like I say, it's slow motion, and everything is played. My lover makes my life complete. You know, you complete me. that you make me so. You make me want to be a better person. Problem is, it's a false type of redemption. No human being can live up to that. They can't pay the freight on those types of promises. I have a good friend, and he used this expression with me a while back. And he said, yeah, you know, when I was younger, I was really bad off. And he used this expression. He says, I was saved by the love of a good woman. You heard that one before? Saved by the love of a good woman. Now, the problem with this is I know his wife. And his wife is the most worn out, fatigued person I think I've ever met in my life, because she can't live up to this. I mean, she's just miserable in many ways, because she's kind of had to become, or maybe she was in the beginning, I don't know, this control freak that constantly has to keep the family together, constantly has to be the peacemaker, constantly have to do this. You can't hold up to that. You can't look to one person to do that. You know, and I've gotten together with her sometimes, and I've said, Karen, would you quit engaging in this idolatry that this is your job? This is God's job to be the peacemaker. This is God's job to hold everything together, ultimately. It's not that you can't play some role in that, and we all can, but ultimately, this is, you got to give this to God, you know? Otherwise, you're staying up late nights worrying and losing sleep and all this kind of stuff. You know, no human being can pay the freight on that in anyone's life. Second thing we look at, you know, to give us meaning and identity, self-worth, personal achievement. I fall prey to this. Maybe many of you guys do too. You really enjoy when somebody says, you know what, you're really good at your job. Boy, you're doing a great job for us. They throw you a banquet. They give you awards. You're teacher of the year. You know, whatever, you know, it might be. And again, all of those things in of themselves, nothing, you know, nothing wrong with that. But what happens when you're not getting all of those compliments? What happens when you don't get a good performance review? You know, these kinds of things. Think about professional athletes. Have you seen how many of them end up after they retire, or after they have, even worse, a career-ending injury? Many of them have no idea what their life looks like. I've been an athlete all my life. I've played peewee football since I was 6. Now I can't play football anymore. What am I going to do? Their whole identity is wrapped up in this. You know what I think is a perfect example of the opposite of that? And many of you may have heard of him. He used to quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. Roger Staubach. Roger Staubach had far more success after football than he did playing football. And he had a lot of success, believe me, playing football. I mean, a couple of Super Bowls and, you know, all these kinds of stuff. But he realized at some point, while he was playing football, I'm not going to be able to play football together. I've got 5 kids. He's Catholic, you know, got the big family, all this kind of stuff. Has a biblical worldview. And he realized he needed to start training himself in other things. So he started a real estate company and started working with real estate people, and eventually founded his own company. And he's been able to do a lot of good with that company, besides just, you know, making money for himself, you know, sharing that money with good causes and things like that. He's a remarkably well-adjusted human being. He had his priorities straight. Even when he was playing football, he said, you know, nope, my relationship with God comes first, then my family, and then it's football, it's job, all of these kinds of things. Celebrity, fame. That's the other thing we look to. I think everybody's thinking, wow, you know, if I was famous, if I made all the money, you know, that went along with that, I mean, I wouldn't have any problems. I have a tendency to go with this sometime, you know, especially when it comes to the money, the bank account, all these kinds of things. A few of you may have visited Graceland. I visited, you know, at a couple of times. I like Elvis Presley, liked his music, all of these kinds of things. I think Elvis was raised in a Christian background. But Elvis was looking for something to give his life meaning, and I think he thought celebrity would give that to him. But if you look at that monument to him there in Nashville in Graceland, you know, and you know the end of his life story here, you see the tragedy there, and you see that everything that he thought would bring him happiness, everything that he thought would give his life meaning, It didn't do it. It just didn't do it. When we get what we think we want, sometimes it just doesn't satisfy there. And so those are not things that do give our lives meaning here. To end with here today, I want to share this quote. It's a rather long quote because it's an excerpt from a commencement address by an individual who's not a Christian, not a believer. I think he's just kind of a totally, you know, secular guy. He's a writer. But I think this is interesting that he would say this. And I'm just going to read through this. It's a couple of slides. There is actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus or Allah or Yahweh or the Wiccan mother goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, and you'll end up feeling weak and afraid. And you will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious. They are default settings. Kind of goes right along with the book, doesn't it? They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into, day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. Like I said, this guy's not a Christian. He's David Foster Wallace. He was an American writer and university professor in English and creative writing. One of his novels was listed by Time Magazine as one of the 100 best English language novels published between 1923 and 2005. His last novel, The Pale King, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2012. He also killed himself at the age of 46. See, this guy understood intuitively that you've got to put something ultimately at the top that's bigger and that transcends all the stuff. But the tension between that was so strong and making the leap to actually do that, he couldn't handle it. And the idols in his life finally destroyed him. Just kind of ate him out, like he says, eat you alive. Because all these forms of worship, as he states, we're not always conscious of them. They're just things that we've fallen into, the messages that we get out there. And so it becomes extremely important that we kind of look at these things. You know, what are these things that I'm still playing? What's this fire that I'm still playing with out there? But I will tell you this, and I'll just tell this to those here today that might be a little younger here. It's easier to find these things out when you're younger. The older you get, the more we practice these things, the more unconscious it becomes. I think that's why the writer of Ecclesiastes says, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you say, I find no pleasure in them." You know why you find no pleasure in them, finally, as you get older? Is because they have eaten you up and just spit you out. Get this as much as you can while you're young. You'll be so far ahead of the game otherwise. It's easier to see these things actually when you're young. hunger because they're more felt than stuff that you actually consciously think about. Because again, one way I think we can approach it and get it more from the unconscious to the conscious, think, what's your worst nightmare? What do you have nightmares about? What's that thing or person that if you lost it, you just think, I just couldn't go on? Whenever we turn a good thing into an ultimate thing, what happens when you lose that? Well, it'll destroy you. Because that's in occupying a place that it's not supposed to. Guys, if you want to, you can just turn off the PowerPoint. For this to have any kind of substance or relevance to y'all, I have to model what I'm saying here. I have to be transparent about it. So I'm going to do that as hard as this is going to be this morning. I wish I just had one idol. I've got way too many. But let's go ahead and start with one. When I was a young man, I bought into a prosperity gospel. I'll just admit it. I'll just confess it. And the reason why I'm confessing that to you guys is I didn't really know that until recently. See, I thought prosperity gospel was do this, do this, do that, and God will make you rich. That's the normal definition of the prosperity gospel, right? If you do these things, God will prosper you and make you rich. That's only one form of it. See, I bought into a prosperity gospel that says, you know, if I do this, and if I do this, and if I do this with my kid, and if I raise them this way, and if I do that, it's pretty much guaranteed that my kids are going to turn out happy, well-adjusted, committed Christians, devoted followers of Christ. And that was an idol. I'll just confess you right now, I set myself up as an idol there. You don't get any guarantees that your kids are going to turn out great. That verse over there in Proverbs, train up a child, we've talked about this. That was never meant to be a guarantee. That's just a statement of a general truth there. It doesn't deal with all the specifics there. And I've shared some examples with you guys about how, you know, that's blown up in my face more than once. A week ago Friday, I got a call. My son's been living with my daughter because he's had some real struggles. He had quit his job. He's had struggles with drugs and alcoholism. We got a call. He was suicidal. Wife and I had to rush over there. He agreed to go to the emergency room. He agreed to get some help. After that, he was admitted to a free clinic. He was there for a week, just recently dismissed from that. I'm hoping and praying that the light's gone on over his head. Many of you know Stephen. He visited here with me, you know, many times as a young child and stuff. See, what's happened is I've seen my idol just blow up in my face. And I understand I should never have elevated that above just my personal devotion and commitment and trust in God to always do what's right for my children rather than trust in my own efforts. Because I'm going to tell you, my efforts are never going to be enough with my kids. Nobody can pay the freight on that. It doesn't mean I won't do everything in my power to always be there for them, to help them, to be the best father that I possibly can. It doesn't mean I won't pray for them. It doesn't mean, you know, all of those things that we do as parents. But I have to understand at the end of the day that their decisions are their own and that there is a powerful God who loves them. Their story is not finished yet, and I have to trust in that. Otherwise, I will tell you this, if I don't, it will absolutely destroy me. Because I'm already pretty close. Now, it's not going to destroy me. Because I've got you. I've got other Christians in my life. I've got a God who loves me awesomely. So, I'll be okay. You know. But not if that's my God. Not if I worship a counterfeit God on that. So this morning, if you have those, if you're struggling with those counterfeit gods. And you need help, like I do, putting those aside and putting God at the ultimate place where he belongs and not these other things of personal achievement and intellect and all these financial security, all those other things. I just ask you to get help for that while we have prayer time later. If you've never accepted this Jesus who makes it possible for you to put God in this ultimate place that gives you a heart of flesh and from a heart of stone, you'll have a chance to respond to that because we're going to sing a song and you can be baptized into him and you can start that road towards dethroning the counterfeit gods and putting the real God where he belongs. So if you want to respond to this in any way today, I just urge you to do so while we stand and while we sing.